Okay, so our next speaker will be Dan McShay. So Dan has developed methods for studying large-scale trends in the history of life, especially trends in complexity, and this work has culminated in a recent book that he wrote with the philosopher Robert Brandon called Biology's First Law, which argues that whereas the default tendency of physical systems in the absence of forces is to remain as they were, biological systems have a default tendency, in fact, to drift, to diversify, and to complexify in the absence of evolutionary forces. And Dan is currently working on hierarchy theory, especially as it relates to goal-oriented behavior, as well as the causal relation between reason and emotion and its implications for cognitive ethology. And he has a big picture view of the history of life that I'll always be envious of, and he's one of the most innovative scientific thinkers that I know. So please welcome Dan. His talk is titled Convergence on What?
Thank you, Russell and Irina, for giving me a chance to, two things, give an entirely data-free talk, which I've always wanted to do, and also the opportunity to give a talk on something I know nothing about. So, convergence. What's the likelihood of the evolution of thinking beings on Earth or elsewhere, beings that think like us? What's the likelihood that their intelligence, their reasoning, their thought processes are going to be anything like ours? I think the answer requires clarity on what we mean by thinking. I think we need more than vague categories like cognition and intelligence and reason and smartitudinosity or whatever words we want to invoke to point in the general direction of that vague notion of cognition. We need a real taxonomy of mind. Otherwise, when we ask about convergence of mind, it's going to be like asking about convergence on wing when we don't know what a wing is. Yeah, bats and birds both evolved wings. What about tumbleweeds? Do tumbleweeds have wings? Or is a tumbleweed a wing? I don't know. It depends on what you mean by wing. You'd better get clear on what you mean by it before you ask that question. So I'm going to start with a story. I'm going to read you a story. Imagine you're alone in a room with a perfectly logical being. The being has in its memory the totality of human knowledge. It can also speak. But even before you begin to talk, a fire breaks out in a trash can. That'll happen. You leap up and head for the fire extinguisher, sensibly mounted on the wall nearby. What are you doing? The perfectly logical being asks. There's no real urgency yet. The fire is inside the trash can. As you scan the extinguisher instructions, you answer the perfectly logical being, I'm putting out the fire, you say. Why? The perfectly logical being asks evenly, no trace of concern in its voice. Because the room will fill with smoke, of course, you answer a little impatiently. So what? The being intones. If the room fills with smoke, we won't be able to breathe, you answer only half attentively now because the extinguisher instructions are in six languages, which is confusing. So what? The being intones again. If we can't breathe, we'll die. Now you're upset. You found the instructions you can read, but what are they saying? There's a pin somewhere on this fire extinguisher, and you're supposed to pull it. Where's the damn pin? Who writes these things? The room is filling with smoke. I don't know about you, but I want to stay alive, you bark at the thing. Why? It intones. Because I just do, you explode, now panicking and furious with the perfectly logical being. But then you have an idea. Take advantage of its perfectly logical mind. Handing the extinguisher to the perfectly logical being, you bark at him, here, figure this out. Put the fire out. Do it now. The being does nothing. You grab him and haul both him and yourself out of the room to safety. I had to give it a happy ending. So what happened here? The perfectly logical being had the same facts that you had all facts. I gave it the totality of knowledge. But it had no wants or preferences, not even a preference for survival. Facts are ideas. Wants are mental events. Events don't follow logically from ideas. Events can be caused by ideas, but not entailed by them. So there is a connection of some kind between ideas and wants, but it's in brain wiring somehow. It's non-logical. A perfectly logical being wants nothing, cares about nothing, prefers nothing. It's completely inert. And I should point out right now, some of you will have noticed it, that whole conversation was unrealistic because the perfectly logical being asked you questions and listened to the answers. Why would it do that? It has no cares, preferences, desires of any kind. So I had to dress up the story to make it a little bit non-logical just for there to be a story. My mission here is going to be to convince you that mere thinking, reasoning, logic, all those are not enough for human-style intelligence, that what I'll call affect is way more important, that the central question for convergence is about affect, and that the whole modern notion of reason, and maybe even the modern notion of cognition, is philosophically confused. So let me put a more positive spin on that. The argument is going to be that human thought processes are actually can be broken down into three categories. There's a category I'll call logic. There's the want, desire, preference category. And then there's a third category that I invented to make things work out just right, a sort of extra category that I thought was needed. I'm calling it scenario building, and I'll tell you what that is in just a bit. I have logic there in heavy quotes. By logic, I'm using it as a kind of shorthand for a bunch of stuff. I'll just attempt to label it now. Pure intelligence, pure cognition, calculation, memory, problem solving. I mean all the non-affective processes. When I say want, desire, and preference, I'm including everything from inclinations to drives to urges to predilections to hankerings to cottonings to, I went through the thesaurus to come up with this. Everything affective goes into that category except for storytelling, which I'll talk about. So here's the outline. I'm going to try to convince you of all this via David Hume's theory of action. I'm going to add something to Hume, this scenario building capacity. I'm going to offer a reparsing of concepts, especially the modern concept of reasoning, of reason. Again, following Hume, I'm going to discuss some objections, and then I'll come back to convergence. So, Hume's theory of action. Two claims. First one, ideas, logic, cannot entail a want, desire, or preference. These are obviously modern terms. They're not Hume's terms. I better add that Hume uses the word reason, but he doesn't mean what we mean by it today, so I didn't want to use his word, which would have confused things. Hume's terms for want, desires, and preferences, the way I'm using them, would have been something like compassion, and we don't use passion the way he used it, so again, I'm translating into my language, into a more modern language. Hume identified two kinds of logic, a priori logic, math, geometry, syllogisms, the sum of all the angles, interior angles of a triangle is 180 degrees, and my daughter told me to make the next one a syllogism about tapers. She said all successful talks have a picture of a baby taper in them. So here's my taper syllogism. All tapers are ungulates. This is a taper. Therefore, this is an ungulate. Did it work? Baby taper? Okay, good. We're cool. second category of logic, empirical logic. Example, I calculate, if I'm a student in a classroom, based on my knowledge of the facts of social dynamics, that if I raise my arm, I will get attention. Or an engineer calculates, based on his or her knowledge of physics and civil engineering, that the compression on a bridge support is 300,000 tons. these are all logical consequences, some of them chains of ideas, but they are all ideas. Having 180 degrees, being an ungulate, getting attention, weighing 300,000 tons, they're all statements, they're all ideas, they're representations in the mind. And the that's Hume's word, representations, but I think it still works in modern terms. Now here's Hume's argument. Deliberate action requires wants, desires, and preferences, but wants, desires, and preferences have no representative quality to them. They're not propositions. They make no claim about the world. They're not representations. So I want the red Maserati. I can draw the red Maserati. I can direct your attention to the red Maserati. What I can't draw is wanting a red Maserati. How would I doll up the picture of the car in order to represent the wanting of it? There's no way to do it, right? Because it's not a representation. The claim is not a proposition. It wants make no claim about the world. So how can something with no representative quality, like a want, desire, or a preference, follow logically from a representation? The answer is it can't. And to say it does would be a category mistake. Putting it in even more modern terms, a want, desire, or a preference is an event in a brain. Logic is about relationships of ideas. How can an event follow logically from an idea? Important clarification here. Ideas are representations, all right, but they're also events in a brain, right? I have an idea about the bridge or about the taper. My having an idea about it is a brain event. Can't idea as brain event cause a want, desire, or preference in that way? And the answer, of course, is yes, it can. But by the wiring of the brain, not by logical entailment. So just as thunder follows lightning as a matter of physics, not logic, there's no logic to it, there's just physics to it, so wants, desires, and preferences can follow ideas as a result of brain wiring, not logic. Better way to put it is, wants, desires, and preferences are evoked. They're not entailed. Hume's second claim. Ideas, logic, can't oppose a want, desire, or preference. I can't think my way out of wanting something. I can't reason, in Hume's term, my way out of wanting something. How can a representation oppose something with no representative quality? So, she didn't advocate for the cheesecake, but I thought, food, lunch, we're up against lunch. I should work some food into this. Maybe that was bad logic, actually. There's a reason not to. Anyway, I'm walking down the street. I pass a bakery. I see a cheesecake in the window. I want to buy it and eat it all right now. I love cheesecake. But then I stop, and I consider, and I logically infer the consequences based on my knowledge of the world of eating that whole cheesecake right now. I'm going to feel sick. There's going to be long-term health consequences to it. You can just picture the arteries getting clogged as each spoonful goes. Isn't what happens, but that's the way causality works in my head on these things. And then if there's anybody watching, if there's anybody out there who I know, it's going to be a little embarrassing to appear so gluttonous, right, publicly, to be, you know, spooning down, filling my gut with an entire giant, I think that thing's about 9 inches in diameter. That's a large cheesecake. It's going to be embarrassing. And that's a deterrent as well. So I don't buy the cheesecake, or if I do, I buy one slice and I eat just. It looks like a triumph of rationality over passion, right? Passion drove you almost to eat that cheesecake. Reason, rationality stepped in. No, it didn't. The reasoning, the rationality, the calculation that was involved was in the computation of the consequences. Having understood the consequences, then there was this mysterious aversive brain reaction called a want, desire, or passion. I want to be healthy. I want to have to live a long life. I do not want to be embarrassed. And these are wants, right? And they don't follow logically from any of the conclusions of my reasoning. They just follow in time. So a desire for health, a desire not to appear gluttonous, triumphed over another desire to eat the whole thing. And that's how it works. That's how decision works, how conscious decision works, at least in people. Coalitions of wants, desires, and passions triumph over other wants, desires, and passions. The idea of health has zero motive power. The idea of survival has zero motive power. What has motive power our wants, desires, and preferences. They are motive power. Okay. Scenario building. I'm going to add something to my list of logical capabilities. I'm not sure where to put it, so I made a third category. We don't just calculate deduce, and infer. We also tell hypothetical stories and react affectively to them. I imagine eating the whole cheesecake. I'm telling a story to myself. I'm imagining a future in which I've eaten the whole cheesecake, imagining the pain in my gut, imagining the embarrassment and so forth. This is a kind of little storytelling that I'm doing, and then I'm reacting affectively to it. Let me tell you a longer story that I'm hoping many of you can connect with for political reasons, if not for intellectual reasons. My cable company is a monopoly in my area, and they just sent me a notice about a month ago telling me that my already outrageous cable rates would rise again. My sense of fairness violated, I flew into a silent rage, rapidly formulating a plan to drive to corporate headquarters and do something terrible, maybe rip out their bloody cable connection. That'll teach them a lesson, I snarled. Is anybody connecting with this? Yeah, okay. As the minutes passed, my rage died down. I'm well-raised, pretty well-raised. Calmer passions engaged, and my mind set to work building imaginative scenarios. I imagined the company catching my vandalism on camera, calling the police, pressing charges. I imagined myself led away in handcuffs, appearing in court, writing checks to lawyers. I imagined the disapproving looks of family and friends. I saw that my actions would not teach the company a lesson. They would not lower their rates. They would just up the bribes that they pay regulators and build a higher fence around their cable connection. So the imagined scenes then triggered a very specific and very powerful negative reaction. I emphatically did not want any of those consequences. And when I say triggered, I don't mean logically. I mean just triggered somehow. This affective reaction. The plan to corporate headquarters faded. Still angry, I engaged in more scenario building, responding affectively, non-logically to each imagined scenario in turn. And you can guess what I did at the end. I wrote my congressperson. How many of you wish I'd gone down there and ripped out, on your behalf, their cable connection? Sorry, I'm up in high dudgeon about this. Okay, so what we're doing here in this story built, this storytelling, with this storytelling capacity is we're deploying these stories as what Hume would have called scouts of the passions. There are things that go forth ahead of us to evoke passions that react to situations that don't exist. It's not an affective process. It's not a driven process exactly. I don't know what else to call it except storytelling. It's close to logic, but it's really long-chain logic, complete with a visual and component and often other senses engaged as well. Okay, the philosophical heart of the talk, I guess. This is the takeaway slide of my damnation of the word reason. Hume divided up mental capacities into two categories. The non-affective capacities, Humean reason, which I've been calling logic in quotes throughout this talk, that's on the one hand. On the other hand are all of the passions, both the calm passions and the violent passions. By the violent passions, well, we would use the word emotions nowadays, joy, disgust, fear, anger, right? But they're all in the same category for Hume with wants, desires, and preferences, and cares, and so forth. They're all the oomph that we have behind our behavior, all of it. There is none over on the left under reason. What we've done in today's language is use the word reason for this funky mix of non-affective capacities and calm passions, mild affective capacities. So in thinking about the cheesecake, I applied reason, meaning I did some calculations and some wants were evoked by it. Those are two really different processes that are captured under a single term. I'm going to vote that we abolish the word reason, and to the extent that cognition is used as a synonym for it, I want to abolish it too, and go back to Hume's categories, which we have the non-affective capacities and the affective capacities cleanly separated. They are logically independent of each other, with no rational connection possible between them. Okay, I started out late last night putting together a slide called Objections and then decided there aren't any. There really aren't. You're welcome to try to come up with them, but the logic of this argument, I'm trying to get responses afterwards. The logic of this argument is really airtight. Good luck. Okay, back to convergence. Be mucho arm waving here. Convergence, let's go through the three categories: logic, scenario building, and wanting, desiring, preferencing. Logic. Convergence seems inevitable because, and I'm on shaky ground here, philosophers help me out, there is only one logic. And I was about to say, there is only one memory. Things are either recorded or they're not. Actually, I can think now of several ways to mess with that. But I'm pretty confident there's only one kind of logic. So if brains get big elsewhere or in reruns, they're going to have logic. They're going to be fast or slow at it yet. There's various parameters to tune. But that's not an issue. Scenario building. As an extension of logic, it is kind of an extension of logic. It's long chains of logic with sensory components to it and imaginative components to them. And it's also a great way to explore alternatives for problem solving. I'm not totally convinced there aren't other ways to achieve the same thing. So I'm not willing to say that's inevitable. Wanting, desiring, preferencing, and affective processes general. Well, some affective processes, the bus barreling down on me, scaring the hell out of me, right? That's an affective response to an envisioned situation, or even just imagining the bus bearing down on me causes some fear response. That's going to be universal. Responses like that, strong affective responses that are connected with survival and reproduction, are probably going to be universal. But that's not all there is to human psychology by any means. That's not all there is to the human affective list by any means. And I just threw up a bunch of ones that occurred to me here. Respect, love, serenity, inspiration, exhilaration. It's a hugely long list of affective capacities that we have. And what are the odds that another species, in an independent evolutionary event of some kind, is going to produce the same list of wants, desires, and preferences? And that just strikes me offhand as a low probability event. But I don't really care whether I'm right or wrong about any of the likelihood of convergence on any of these. What I want to focus on is this. I think this is the question involved in for convergent minds, convergence on affect. Thank you.